even though Eddie represented financial security?
Yes, there was just something about Milton's personality and character, and they thought his potential.
They were right.
Kind of person that he was, and the kind of life that I would be leading with Milton. To Mother and Dad, and this is true of Milton and me, that perhaps the most important thing is that one lead a life of integrity and respect. We don't ask that people love us, but we ask that people respect us.
And you and Milton both have this in common.
Yes.
From the time.
To us, and this was my father and mother too. And that you be a person. I think it was almost like the kind of thing that I read that Mr. Justice Holmes had said. And I think that this grasps almost the our philosophy. I'm paraphrasing him. Mr. Justice Holmes, but he said that for a person to be alive, he had to take part in the actions and passions of his time.
Milton were both committed.
And Milton and I were both committed to this kind of thinking. And I think it's the kind of thinking that my father and mother had expressed perhaps in different semantics.
I still feel it was most unusual to have this commitment. How did you feel about the role your mother played in the life that she led?
Oh, I've had tremendous admiration for my mother. I had tremendous pride in her. When I said something about not getting along with her, it's not that I've rebelled against her. When I say I don't get along, it's just that I take issue with her mm-hmm. on certain things.
Well, that's a sign of respect, too.
And and this really only began happening after my father's death. Not prior to my father's death. It was after my father's death, and I think then it was my mother's... My mother had my father to cling to or to control or to live with or whatever. And maybe mother's needs of that to have her family, to give her a feeling of security.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Of having something. And this was when my mother's controls began to show.
Oh, and you first began to feel pressure, which you never felt before.
Oh, never, 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 never. My mother is a remarkable, remarkable woman. As my father was a remarkable man. That was an extremely good marriage where they really, where they complemented each other. And it's an interesting thing that the pattern of lives of their four children, of the partnership, a relationship, of the equality and respect relationship exists in with her four children and her spouses.
That's most interesting.
I mean, in not one instance of the four of us has a spouse played a minor role. It's an equal role.
Yes, we do learn from our parents.
And the respect and everything. We all believe in the dominant role of the male.
In what respect?
I mean, the fact that the male is the head of the house. I mean, and is the final, if there is a difference of opinion, the final opinion becomes his. And you talk things out and this and that, but this becomes the last word.
I just can't quite see. I can see it in your case only as an agreement on the
last. That's right. That's exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's not domination. We married and people whom we respected.
Which is a very wise choice in a marriage partner.
Each one of us did that. And so that in the marriage, it has been a partnership factor.
I would certainly just, the little observation of you and Milton is certainly a partnership factor.
Yeah.
But you've said twice that the male is dominant, and I just wondered, didn't you?
Well, I mean, I couldn't stand, I would be extremely unhappy, Corinne, if I were married to a man whom I could boss around. I would have, because I couldn't respect him. If he would let me dominate him and control, I could have no respect for him because I think he was a weakling. And if he's a weakling, I don't want him in my life.
That's right. So you did choose wisely.
Yeah. So I mean, then on the other hand, I would be equally miserable married to someone who tried to dominate me. Who would try to force his opinions on me. This I could not endure. This I couldn't tolerate.
Fortunately, you don't.
So I mean, this is the kind of thing that we all have.
That's all four of you children in this kind of marriage. That mm-hmm. really,
I mean,
does say something about your parents.
Yeah,
and their experience.
Now, my older sister was a very dependent person. But even in her dependency needs, she married a person where he didn't dominate her, but she leaned on him.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great deal of difference, you know, between being dominated
and
someone being supportive. Very much so. And I think you see that this is what we've been fortunate enough to have. And hopefully our children will have these same kinds of things. Although there is, I mean, I'm skipping into another thing. And this hops into the marriage kind of a thing. When Milton and I were married, he supported his parents.
When were you married?
In October 18, 1936.
Oh, then you had a long romance.
Mm-hmm. Depression, you had to. And we married even when Milton wasn't in a position to get married because of the financial end of it. I remember Harold and Stephanie came. You knew Harold.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Harold and Stephanie and Milton and I were together that New Year's Eve, introducing the year 1936, and the four of us were weeping copiously on each other's shoulders because Harold and Milton and Stephanie and I were in the same positions. Harold was supporting his mother and his brother and his sisters. Jean wasn't working at the time, and neither in the position to get married, and it looked like a forever deal. Well, they were married in August of 36, and we were married in October of 36. We moved in. Reverend Milton stayed where he was, and I moved in with his parents. We converted his bedroom into sort of a studio. And I guess it was because of the fact that we were living with other people that it influenced our lives a great deal. Now, even though the other people were his parents, it still was more than just Milton and myself. And we'd have a difference of opinion. We wouldn't fight. We would talk it out because we would want to speak in low voices. And when you speak in a low voice, you never say things that you regret. You're able to keep better control. And so that you talk. You don't scream and yell. And it wasn't until I didn't realize, this was the pattern of our lives. We would talk something through. But when Bix was about 9 or 10 years old, I recognized the hazards of what they had done. Something happened, and for the first time, we really blew.
You lost control,
were sitting up in our den, the three of us, and Milton and I got into a real hassle. And all of a sudden, we looked, and there was Bix, face white as a ghost, just totally ashen and petrified. He had never heard Milton and me fight, because there'd been no reason for it.
Oh, wow.
And we talked about it later, Milton and I, that we really had done Bix an injustice. I mean, for him to grow up feeling that people never argued, never fought, or that a fight meant the end of everything.
Well, grew up in a house where there was such perfect control.
Well, the thing is this, though, it was unrealistic. I mean, most people don't exercise that. Really wasn't a case of Milton and I, you know, being rigid about controlling ourselves. This was been we've gotten accustomed to talking something through.
Don't you think that may have gone back to before you were married and living in his parents' home, all the years you knew each other and law school?
It could possibly, all of these
waiting
things.
Waiting to get married.
But the thing is this, the damage that could have been done to Bix, of not realizing that people can argue and people can become very angry, and that it doesn't mean the end of the world, that you can fight and still have deep regard for one another, that fighting doesn't mean hating.
It was such a shock to
That's right, I mean, because he had always equated, after all, he was a television era kid. And from what he had seen on television, and from what he had, the movies or what have you, or wherever else he might have been, and he would hear that there were these fights and arguments, this only happened when there was bitterness. So to him, it became like the end of the world. And we were talking about it not too long ago, the three of us. And he said it was a tremendous shock to him. And he thought his world had come to an end.
What an experience.
Yes, and
fortunately.
So when I say it was not, I mean, this was not a realistic, it was great and is great for us.
It makes for very pleasant living.
It makes for great living. It makes for great living, provided it is not a false control. If it's a false control, and I think this is what was upset Bix, the way we had lived was such a natural thing, and where he knew there were differences of opinion, because he'd hear his father and I having differences of opinion and disagreeing, that he didn't grow up in too artificial an atmosphere, where people kept all of their thinking, real thinking, buried. And this is when problems do come up. So fortunately, we never kept our problems buried.
Well, he had two talkers for parents.
Oh, God.
Two good reasoners.
And he's the same way. He's as much of a talker as we are.
That's important for
him. But how about this is enough for today?
I think it's just fine. And we'll start tomorrow with your long engagement. And then go on to your adult life.
Okay, fine.
Thanks, man. This is the beginning of our third interview with Min Sussman on July 17, 1974. And Min, today I'd like to be a little bit more specific and to get into the real, factual, measurable kinds of changes in your life. I wonder if you could describe the activities. What was a week in your life the year you were a senior in high school? What year was that?
That was in September, it would be September 25, because I was graduated in January of 26. I seem to remember, one thing I remember very vividly, I guess it was a matter of show-offiness or something else. I developed a pattern of never being in school on Monday morning. I went to school then, from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. And after school, I would be with my friends, and we would go to the drugstore, where everyone had it was the in place. And we would have a Coke and be very busy watching everyone else and talking and, of course, being very interested and concerned about what everyone was doing.
Did you go with the same group every day?
Yes. I'm sure you have to belong. I would come home for dinner, or perhaps go to the home of a friend's for dinner, with permission from my parents. I should say this, that every day I would stop in at my parents' store, which is on Main Street, 3/4.
Was this near the drugstore?
Yes, it was 2 doors away. Then in the evening, do homework, whatever was necessitated, and then read. Didn't go out very much during the week. Over the weekends would be perhaps going to a movie, we'd have what we call pajama parties. The group would get together, and the girls who were fortunate enough to have dates would go out.
How many in your group?
Oh, there must have been about 7 or 8 of us, all Christian. The only time I saw my Jewish friends was on Sunday. Sunday morning, we would go to religious school. I was confirmed when I was 16, but I was confirmed the June before I was graduated from high school, so that the two things did come together. Sunday would be the days off with my Jewish friends. And that was
Did the Jewish friends go to the same high school?
Yes, we only had them in high school. But because of the smallness of the Jewish community, there were probably never more than 1 or 2 Jews, 3 at the most, in any class, any high school class. And this was true in the elementary grades. And then I should imagine that there were many classrooms in the elementary areas that didn't have any Jewish children.
So your friends that you went with after school were classmates?
Yes, very definitely. But they were classmates, not of the class with which I was graduating, but my own age group.
Awesome. What did you do on Saturdays?
Saturday, I don't recall. I mean, we'd get together, you'd sleep until noon. And then you'd get together with your gang, and you'd fiddle around someone's home. And one of the girls had some kind of a jalopy, and we used to pile into that and drive around during the school year. Of course, during football season, we were all avid football fans. And went to the football games and then parade up and down Main Street when we won. And then we'd get together at someone's home in the evening. And that was the night when we usually slept over on the floor. God forbid you should sleep in beds. And then during the basketball seasons, would be going to the basketball games, and at that time, groups would get together to, you'd go either on a scheduled streetcar, at that time the Harmony Short Line, or on a bus to the communities where the teams were playing. And we were very, very much a part of everything, very involved in school activities and school interests, whether it be the newspaper. There was always a big thing with the plays that were put on.
Were you part of the newspaper?
Yes. Sort of a little flunky on it because, again, this was due in large part to the fact that I was never part of any particular academic or school activity relating to the class because I kept changing grades so rapidly.
As you moved through.
So it was, I was part of a group insofar as friendships were concerned, but as I say, not with my own age group. And because the school paper was primarily the responsibility of the senior graduating class, I was never really part of that senior graduating class.
So you moved into it.
I was very peripheral. Mm-hmm. Very peripheral in terms of that. But I had it was a very good life, and I enjoyed it tremendously.
Very good. Was Junior Hadassah also a part of that high school life?
No. Junior Hadassah was not. Oh, yes, it was. That was very peripheral. I was never really too excited or interested in that.
But you did belong to it.
Oh, yes. You belong to anything of a community nature, anything of a Jewish nature. But I wasn't too friendly with too many of the Jewish kids because they didn't live in my neighborhood. There were just maybe three or four of us that lived on our end of town. So we didn't get to see people too often who lived on the other end of town.
I understand. How about life with your parents during those years? Did you have family activities with brothers and sisters and parents?
Oh, there were the community activities. Where there'd be the community picnics, or we'd go out to the parks on picnicking. And, of course, the big thing in the summer was coming in, driving into Pittsburgh. This was the event that we looked forward to. We were a close family, and yet we went our separate ways. Mm-hmm. It happened that Mother and Dad were busy in the store, and then they were very active in the community and their own social life. But it was sort of a we kind of a thing, togetherness without being an overwhelming kind of thing. So in terms of socializing and doing things, no, I was never close friends with my sisters and my brother. Mm-hmm. We all found our friendships outside.
Awesome.
But we were involved with each other and concerned with each other.
Well, that certainly you've made obvious from other things that you've said. All right, can we go on to a week during a year at Pitt undergraduate school?
There, I always try to arrange my schedule so that I would have my classes in the morning and the afternoons free.
Where did you live when you went to
with Pitt? My cousins. Max and Minnie Goldhammer, she was my father's niece. And I lived with them, and they had just the one child at that time. I was about four when I came to live with them. And it was very pleasant. I had a home, and yet I was not confined. And I would take the streetcar to Pitt. It was about a 10-minute ride because lived out in the in the East Liberty District. And my classes were in the morning. And
what year? When did you start?
In January of 26. And I got to know people fairly quickly. I wasn't eligible for sorority. They had delayed rushing at Pitt at that time, and I wasn't eligible for sorority for rushing because I made a D in botany. I did not come I didn't come through with a C average. Well, I know I told you about this experience I had with Harold Norman, how it totally influenced my life, this young man who told me a few things about myself. And I was not a student at Pitt.
But you were a student all your life, from elementary school on.
I rarely cracked a book at Pitt. I don't know what happened there. I really didn't exert myself at all.
Was it that you had a different goal, which was not to be
social? Yeah. And so the afternoons were spent. At first, we had I'd meet everybody ate at the cafeteria, which was in the old dental infirmary, which was a madhouse and just horrible. But this is, you know, everybody goes to the in place, even if you're very fringe and peripheral.
But you weren't, were you? Were you still fringe and peripheral? Your first term?
Well, I got to know people, and I began going out a bit with a young man who was a Phi Ep. And the days went quickly. I'd come home then around 4 o'clock, 4:30. And my evenings, during the week, I didn't go out, I didn't date at all during the week. And I think I read a great deal, or was on the telephone. And then I was made my grades, I was accepted into sorority, and it became the center of my social life. And a typical day was going to going to classes in the morning and then going to the Shenley coffee shop for lunch, where you had a very leisurely kind of lunch, and popular lunch was French fried potatoes. That was, and I think a Napoleon for dessert. This consisted of the meal. And then in the afternoon, you hung around, batted around with some of your friends. And the weekends, the dating consisted of going dancing. And you got very, very dressed up. In fact, you got very dressed up for school, too, in tailored clothes. But the thing to do was to go dance.
And where did you go dance?
At Webster Hall. It was the place to go for all ages. And Dewey Bergman was the orchestra. Later, we started going downtown to the Green Pen, there was a room that they had in the basement, I forget what it was called, and then there was the urban room up on the 17th floor. And then there was also a room off the lobby, I don't recall.
One was the terrace room.
The terrace room. And that was the day of the big bands. And you would go and you would order a fruit lemonade. Because that, of course, was prohibition. And you dawdle over a fruit lemonade for a couple hours.
Oh.
And then later you would go out to a place like Child's, or to Gammon's in East Liberty, and this was the evening. Or you would go to a movie, and the lines were enormously long. This was the time when they began building these very rococo movie palaces. The days of the tremendous stage shows. With the Masters of Ceremonies, this was the day when Dick Powell, he first started out at that theater in East Liberty. Forget the name of the movie there that was built at that time. But this was the kind of thing that you did.
Were these things expensive, do you remember? It was no problem.
Everybody had a car, or their parents' car. And the first time I had a date going on the streetcar, I was bitterly ashamed.
Oh.
I mean, this was like going down into the Netherlands for this kind of thing. I was ashamed that someone might see me. I mean, it was very much of a status thing. I mean, our values were those kinds of values.
It's interesting because you always had that career aspiration, yet these years in college.
Well, because I needed this, as I pointed out, my years, 3.5 years of college, were not mental growth, they were social growth, which was a very important thing for me, and a very needful thing.
And fun, sounds like
then
fun.
Then law school was a different kind of a story. Law school was...
Let's go back to undergraduate school first. How about how often did you go home to Butler?
Well, the first year I went home about every other week because I still hadn't fitted in. Once I started fitting in and having more of a social life from friendships where I would be busy over the weekends, mm-hmm. then I rarely went home, just being on occasion. At the risk of digressing, I think it's an interesting thing. My parents were very conservative, as was Butler. And I started using lipstick when I started the college. But when I would be on the trolley going home, that lipstick would be wiped off because that was considered a very sinful thing. Only fallen women wore lipstick. This was in the 20s, even in the height of the flapper era. And of course,
there was a difference then between the cosmopolitan city and Butler.
Oh, very much so. Oh, very definitely. And smoking was verboten. My parents, in fact, I never smoked. I got to the stage where my parents finally knew that I was smoking. But I wasn't permitted to smoke in front of them. It wasn't until the day of graduation from law school. And my parents had taken us for lunch down to the Shenley Coffee Shop. And I, of course, was so excited that I couldn't eat. And I asked my parents for permission to smoke in front of them. That would be my graduation gift. And that was the first time. And from then on, of course, the barrier had been broken. But was there anything else you wanted to inquire of the college days or anything?
Yes,
like that?
Of your Sundays and something about the sorority and sorority meetings.
The sorority meetings were Monday nights, and we would all eat at the Luna restaurant, which was at the corner of Center and Craig Street. And then we would go over to the sorority house, which was up near which was on Craig Street, up near Bond Boulevard. And we'd have our sessions there and until maybe 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and then come home. If we stayed at the house, we had to pay for a cot, or we shared a cot with somebody. And if we ate there, if we ate dinner there, which mm-hmm. we did occasionally, we would have to pay. There was a very much a part of a group and who dominated and ruled our entire lives. I mean, sometimes unnecessarily. I remember one gal who was going with a young man before she was pledged and initiated the sorority. And we in our infinite wisdom felt that he was not AEFI material. And she was not permitted to bring him to our affairs. When I think back, it was excellently appalling.
But this is the extent of the influence.
This was it. I mean, a very important thing to belong. And you arrived, if you were in the sorority, in AEFI. Because it
were
was
most of the girls that in the sorority children of immigrants or children of working people?
No, not working people for the most part. I mean, all the mercantile.
All mercantile. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how many, say you did have a
no
house.
No professional people. Because at that time, look at the immigrant people who hadn't had. We were all children of merchants.
Now, you had a house. Were there many girls from out of town who lived in the house?
Yes, we served. We had very few AEFIs living there. We served as really as dormitory facilities for the out-of-town Jewish girl because we had no dormitories. Pitt was a trolley school.
I understand.
But after I joined the sorority, I still continued to live at my cousin's. In fact, I can't remember there even being discussion with my parents about moving into the house. I guess it was a matter of the economics of the thing.
Was there? There must have been some dissension or some tension between the members and the girls who simply lived there?
No, because you see, the chapter, for the most part, was composed of Pittsburgh girls.
Did you have much to do with the people who lived in the house?
The AEFIs who lived there, not with the other girls. No, it was very cruel.
Yeah,
but it became the gathering place, though. We'd go over an afternoon after lunch or something, go and hang around over the house. And it was the center of activities, and the fraternity boys would come over, you know, and that kind of thing. And it was there was gratification there, too. The pylons, for instance, I had very little to do with the AEFIs, and it started back somewhere at the origins of the sorority. What happened, I don't know, but there was some kind of a hassle, and it was a carried over that became a traditional kind of a thing.
Yeah, these social stratifications, they must have been very important.
AEFI and FIEMS were friendly. SAMs, AEFIs would go out with SAMs, but definitely not with Kappa News. I mean, when you look back at it, it's a very disgusting kind of thing.
Really,
but our own egos were built up. We were the in group, and I guess all of us need, maybe particularly at that time, to be in good.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and it is interesting. Now, law school must have been an entirely different kind
law
of
school
experience.
Life was real, life was earnest. I had classes in the morning, and then we would have lunch over at the Colonnade in the Caucus Building, and then come back and be in the library all afternoon. The law library.
The Copper's Building downtown.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the law school at that time was in the Chamber of Commerce Building. It was on the 10th floor of the Chamber of Commerce Building. And we would be in the library briefing cases, then come home for dinner, and then study all evening, briefing from our case books.
Where did you continue to live with your cousins?
I lived with my cousins all the way through. And the only time that I went out were Friday and Saturday nights. And I had very little, if any, social relationships with any of my sorority sisters because I was busy. My life was totally different. I worked at it. For the first time in my life, I worked, although Milton contends that I still got through with that work.
Well, that's an interesting point. You've made it before. Why do you think he says that? Do you think you made it look as if you weren't working?
Well, it's because I learn quickly, and I read very, very rapidly. So I perhaps could read in an hour and read cases, but it took some of the others several hours to do.
Did some of your professors make it awfully hard for you, being a woman in a male profession?
No, they were rough on all of us. I had, there was no special treatment. Mm-hmm. Except I had one professor, Jim Blackburn, who was very interested in me and gave me a lot of guidance. Now, whether it was because I was a female or because he liked me as a student, I don't know. I know he was the one who advised me in my senior year as to what politics to become involved.
Oh, really? Tell us.
Well, he felt that I was graduating in 32. Jim Blackburn was from the establishment, but he was a liberal for the establishment. And he felt that the new wave of the future was the Democratic Party. And he felt that this was the party with which I should affiliate. It was not
in
the
terms
party.
Why was he interested in
and then because he believed in the social philosophy of the Democrats.
But was he interested in it for because he was trying to convince you to be a Democrat or because
yes.
of your career?
I don't know. I think he was interested in it philosophically.
Uh-huh.
Because of the kind of person that I was and felt that I would fit into that new democratic wave.
Was this the first time that you had been interested in politics?
Yes. It appalls me when I think back. I was in college in 1928, and it wasn't until